Welcome to the Unfit Podcast.
Good morning or good afternoon. I'm Philip Middleton, Chairman of Unfit's Digital Monetary Institute, and I am delighted to be joined this morning in London by Ashley Alder, who has very kindly agreed to record a session with us. Ashley is an enormously senior and influential regulator. He is chair of IOSCO, the board of the International Organization of Securities Commissions, which is a global think tank and policy board for the securities and exchanges markets. And in his spare time, allegedly, is chief executive officer of the Securities and Futures Commission, so the principal regulator in Hong Kong. We've got together this morning to have a conversation really about crypto assets and crypto in its broadest sense, how securities markets regulators are approaching it, whether these are payments or investment assets or gambling, how or whether they should be regulated. And for our conversation, we are not really looking at CBDC this morning because that's covered elsewhere in the seminar. So securities, payments, crypto, whatever. Given the fact that the crypto market allegedly is now, depending on the time of day and the day in question, somewhere approaching $2.1 trillion, which, whilst that sounds a large number, is actually still relatively small compared to the volume going through exchanges and markets more generally, but still significant. There is a growing concern that it may be a source of financial instability, it may be a source of or facilitating criminal behavior, it may be a danger to retail consumers, and indeed it may be a danger to some institutional users. So some big questions about should this be regulated or banned, and if it should be regulated, how are you going to do it, and what are you trying to mitigate, and what failure will you allow if we accept that it's not the job of regulators to prevent commercial failure at any cost? And what approaches should be taken, and what's the balance then between national and international approaches? So we're going to look first initially at the broader international dimension, where there are suggestions that the regulators are still stumbling somewhere behind the markets, and indeed in some parts of the world are stumbling more than others. And then we're going to move from there and look at the Hong Kong dimension. So everyone's paying to hear you, Ashley, so that's enough for me. So over to you.
Okay, well, look, thanks very much for that kind introduction and context setting. I think it's broadly true that the regulators are stumbling behind the market. If you look back where we now are in, you know, we're in May 2022. If you looked out to May last year, the general view of regulators at an international level, that's sort of conversations in the Financial Stability Board and within IOSCO, whose board I chair, and BCBS, et cetera. The view at the time was crypto is relatively niche and doesn't necessarily pose a financial stability risk, partly because of the sheer size or lack of size of the crypto world in comparison to global financial assets and global financial services activity. Mm-hmm. Now, that has completely changed in that very, very short period of time. And what was a sort of wait and see approach has now changed into one where in a recent international meeting, I heard from multiple participants that now it's all about the three C's: COVID, climate, and crypto. So, and crypto then obviously has you know, rocketed up the agenda. So we're now into a period where I think regulators at a national level, at different speeds and taking different approaches in reality, but especially at a global level, this is a very, very large part of the global conversation about financial sector regulation. So the question really is, in a little bit more detail, why is that the case? Well, first, as I've mentioned, we've seen an enormous growth in crypto assets, crypto trading, everything crypto. But also we've seen a very significant growth in or development of complexity around that, and the way in which crypto interacts with many other financial and non-financial entities, individuals and activities. So the complexity aspect, I think, is important. The second is increasing involvement with mainstream finance, or possibly the other way around, mainstream finance becoming increasingly involved with crypto, partly as a result of client demand, whether those clients are retail right through to family offices, from an investment perspective. Thirdly, and I think you alluded to this, why crypto? Why, is there a difference between, is it something that you can leave alone, pure caveat emptor, don't regulate it? Well, I'm sitting in Hong Kong at the moment, just across the border. Crypto, to all intents and purposes, is banned, and it is a choice. It's a political and regulatory choice as to whether to ban it or not, and that to an extent is associated with the focus on central bank digital currencies in China, in mainland China. You can ignore it, or you can regulate it. There's only three things you can do. Ignoring it, if you don't ban it, is simply not viable, because it would simply be an abdication of effectively of a public policy responsibility or public sector responsibility to look at something where there is obviously a lot of promise, particularly around the underlying technology and its applications, but also potentially risks and harms, and including consumer harm. Now, when it comes to crypto and what it claims to be, one of the reasons why I think financial regulators do need to be involved, once you've decided that it's a public sector responsibility to do so, is that crypto does claim to be part of the financial system, in essence. There are multiple claims from multiple aspects of the crypto world that it is money-like in some way. And I think from the position that was held, again, some time ago, not long ago, but some time ago, that because pure crypto assets, such as Bitcoin, have no intrinsic value, and there's always a comparison around intrinsic value and other more familiar financial assets, that therefore, it's not, there was a debate about, is it a commodity? Is it a currency? No, et cetera, et cetera. And does it have the attributes of money? I think there's a view at the moment that one of the attributes, or one of the three main attributes of money, it is starting to resemble, which is a store of value. The jury's still out on whether it's a, it's a viable means of payment, and a unit of account, the other two aspects, but store of value, let's have a look at it. So that's another reason. We've seen also more recently an increasing correlation when it comes to pricing of crypto assets with other risk assets. And finally, I think there's a growing realization, which is a bit of a larger point, that there are aspects of crypto that could inform quite profoundly the future of finance, whether that's central bank digital currencies or private private crypto, as it were, non-central bank, and how they interact. So that's why we're doing it. I think when it comes to the risks, so you know, once you've decided that there's a rationale to look at this from a regulatory perspective, and if you look at the risks that we then need to address, they're multiple, and you know the there is a wall of worry about this in reality, in the conversations at an international, you know, institutional level, and I can go through a film: operational resilience and susceptibility to cyber risk. Operational resilience has seemed to be broadly pretty low in comparison to, you know, conventional financial services and financial systems. Secondly, if problems arise, there are few or no systems of redress. Thirdly, volatility is sort of endemic to the crypto world. Now, volatility is obviously a feature of conventional financial markets, but the relevance of extreme volatility goes to confidence effects, and confidence effects matter so far as financial stability is concerned as the size of the crypto world grows. There is, I think, a very high level high level of opaqueness and an associated, you know, lack of transparency in the crypto world, not only from the perspective of regulators, but obviously from the perspective of participants. There's, of course, which has been trailed for some time, the sort of organized crime and anti-money laundering angle to this. There are questions around legal certainty. There are really important questions, and this is a particular focus when it comes to international institutions around the cross-border aspects. You know, traditional financial services, notwithstanding the fact that many of them tend to be global, still tend to be anchored in jurisdictions, you know, whether listed markets or whether it's financial institutions, such like. That is not the case for crypto. It's extremely fluid when it comes to the sort of nationality of assets and the nationality of platforms.
Let me unpack it with that, because there's a tremendous amount there, Ashley. I suppose my first question is, what is it? What is crypto? You've alluded to the fact that it may be an asset, it may be a form of gambling, it may even be a payment system. And there's an irony here in that many of the promoters of crypto would argue that they are explicitly trying to avoid the conventional financial system, be that of payment or investment. They're trying to get away from regulators. They're trying to get away from traditional financial services for a whole variety of reasons, which range from libertarian philosophy to wanting to make a very, very fast buck. But, you know, there is a difference, massive difference, between a payment instrument such as potentially Bitcoin, all the way through to a laughing monkey NFT, non-fungible token. And then in the NFT sphere, there are some very interesting, plausible commercial business cases emerging, such as, for example, music copyright, because of the immutability and transparency aspects potentially afforded by blockchain. So I think this raises the question about what is it we're regulating, and is this a security? Is it a payment instrument? Is it something else? Secondly, who are we regulating? Because there is a vast array now of players, ranging from conventional financial institutions, existing FIs, who one presumes are regulated anyway, and it shouldn't cause us too much effort to say, well, this is just another financial instrument, so we can slot it into whatever regime we have for financial instruments once we've decided exactly what they are, to a whole host of players who sit way outside the perimeter of current financial services regulation, whether the so-called VASPs, and if I can do some advertising for the FSC, you produced a very, very interesting paper recently on VASPs, and in particular intermediaries with respect to cryptos and some of the issues around that. And I commend it to our audience. It's on your website and a very interesting read. So if we're saying actually there are systemic and institutional risks inherent in some of this stuff, what's our perimeter look like? What are we going to regulate, and who are we going to regulate?
Well, I think firstly, yeah, okay. So I personally don't think that spending too much time on a sort of top-down philosophical overview is particularly helpful. I think that conversation could go, maybe interesting to academics. I think the conversation could be never ending. Secondly, perimeter issues are not confined to crypto. We come across them all the time as regulators. So, you know, in another context, ESG ratings and those firms that assign ESG scores, by and large, are not regulated. But they're very, very important. Of course, there's a conversation going on about whether they should be regulated, because that, again, you know, in the sustainable finance world is to a large extent relatively new. It's not necessarily something that one would associate with traditional financial markets, but it is being looked at as a matter of financial regulation, amongst other things. So if you look at this from a bottom-up perspective, the basic approach is, you know, applying you know, the very familiar mantra of same business, same risk, same rules. That's really what's happening. Then you look at in the context of, you know, financial activity. And as I said earlier, you know, there are effectively, either explicitly or implicitly, there is a claim on behalf of those who promote or are involved in crypto that it is money-like, and it has attributes and performs functions which are similar to or analogous to conventional financial, you know, financial sector activity. So that's I think that's the approach. I think we've also now got to the stage where this may not be comprehensive, but we're looking at this in a few buckets. The first bucket, from, you know, when you take the, you know, same business, same risk, same rules approach, the first bucket is financial stability. And the second bucket broadly is investor protection, which then they overlap. Mm-hmm. And the third bucket is more to do with AML issues, FATF expectations on AML procedures and checks and all that kind of stuff. So that's really where it's at. I think the if you look at, I mean, just to elaborate on that a little bit, if you look at, you know, traditional financial regulation, by and large, it's organized around, you know, distinct entities or institutions or activities. But when it comes to the entities, they're pretty familiar. They're banks, you know, brokers, asset managers, custodians, issuers, you know, et cetera. The issue with crypto, which is why I don't think it's particularly difficult to analyze it from the perspective of a financial markets regulator, is if you look at, say, crypto platforms, by and large, once you break down what they do, they both bundle a set of activities and services which are versions of what you would find in conventional financial services, but they're bundled together. And they also disintermediate as part of that. So, you know, those who interact with crypto platforms will do so directly, not through a third party intermediary, because the intermediary function is bundled into the whole. So you have that. But once you, as I say, once you analyze that, you'll see that many of the activities are very similar. And ultimately, there is effectively an investment case. Now, an analogy to that, which is, again, why you can, to an extent, evade too much of a philosophical view. If you look at the way in which collective investment schemes are regulated in many jurisdictions, it's the scheme itself and the collective nature of that and the fiduciary nature of that, etc. But the underlying property, the underlying investment can be anything. It's not limited to securities. It could be art. It could be, you know, it could be real estate. It could be, you know, whatever, you know, not conventional financial assets. So that's why I think some of these arguments about what it is, what isn't, and such like is a bit misplaced. I think actually we deal with these other problems in other contexts and other aspects of, you know, our work as financial regulators. I think the big thing with this, well, the two big things. Once you've decided that there are sufficient analogies which you can get your arms around, there are two issues. The first of which is lack of a regulatory nexus, particularly when it comes to decentralized finance, the technology stack that operates there, and the claim, at least, that the smart contract or smart contracts have replaced a centralized authority who could have responsibility or could have identified responsibility to a regulator or have legal responsibility. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is I mentioned, which is the sort of shape-shifting cross-border nature of this, where the activity is not anchored to a particular jurisdiction or even more than one jurisdiction. So there are two dimensions of challenge around the connection between what a regulator might want to do and the ability of the regulator to actually have a sufficient nexus with the activity to apply the regulation it feels it's appropriate. And that's not an issue that's been sorted out, which we need to work on.
And from your perspective as chair of IOSCO, where do you think international standard setters are on some of these questions?
Fairly early days. I'd use the word exploratory more than anything else at an international level. Of course, you know, a lot more is being done at jurisdictional level, but it's fairly disparate. So I think, but, you know, in the UK, as far as I understand, right now, it's more about registration from an AML perspective. You know, that might change, you know, going forwards. In the US, the president has asked, you know, the regulatory community to think hard about it, what to do next. So there are different approaches in different places. So I think it's quite early. It's interesting if you compare this crypto and the international conversation and international cooperation around it to, say, climate finance. Climate finance is way ahead. There are so many international efforts at various, you know, the International Sustainability Standards Board, the international platform, the G20 group, et cetera, et cetera. There isn't anything like that for crypto at the moment, which is why actually it's early days. But I do think now it's, as I said, it's seen as one of the three C's. So it's very, very important. It's gone up the agenda. So I would not expect that to be the case same time next year. I think that is bound to change. In fact, all of the we've already set up the working program. So within the Financial Stability Board, one of the principal committees that's chaired by Andrew Bailey is now working on so-called unbacked crypto. That's basically anything that's not a stable coin. And I, together with John Cunliffe at the Bank of England, even last year, we produced a report on the payments dimension of stable coins, you know, which fundamentally concluded that if you apply the international rules relevant to financial market infrastructure, the PFMI, as they're called it, that's the acronym, then what you will find, among other things, is that stable coin, there are big question marks about the fact that the settlement may not be in central bank money or commercial bank money, which is a requirement. And secondly, coming back to the familiar point, you know, is there a legal entity with legal responsibility and regulatory responsibility to a domestic regulator?
And of course, when is a stable coin not a stable coin?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Well, I think people have pointed out that maybe the word stable is promising a little bit too much.
And how do you do that? Can we drop down a level to Hong Kong, where clearly you've got immediate jurisdiction and power to apply practical steps here? What are you doing there?
Actually, I think what we're doing here is in a way where quite a few jurisdictions will get. And interestingly, I think we're doing it a little bit earlier. So there are two elements. The first of which, and the SEC, I think, has also pointed this out. You know, where's the place that most members of the public, most people who interact with crypto, actually do that? And that is in relation to crypto platforms, which people like to call crypto exchanges. So what we have done already is that we've created a regulatory framework for platforms to be licensed with us. And that framework, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier on, it basically combines and adapts to the crypto world a whole set of expectations that you would normally see in conventional areas such as exchanges and brokers and such like. So, you know, it goes through things like, you know, safeguarding client assets, you know, rules around access to the platform, transparency, market manipulation rules, you know, conflicts of interest, risk management, operational risk. You know, it's quite a long list. They're all quite familiar, but they are bundled and adapted. So they're adapted to, you know, custody techniques like wallets, hot and cold wallets, how they operate, how they interact and such like. So that's what we've done with that. The problem we had actually was that our remit, a little bit like the SEC, only goes to securities. And most crypto assets are not securities. Bitcoin is not a security. So we are now in the process of putting through legislation to extend that licensing regime to all platforms trading any crypto asset.
And will that apply to the metaverse as well?
It will apply to a virtual asset service provider platform, which can register. So the metaverse, I think, is more of a concept than a thing that you.
In the online game Middleton World, we use a currency called Alders, which are traded within that world. You know, are you regulating that?
It would depend if there is a platform whereby an asset which may be used in the metaverse or may not be used in the metaverse, if the asset may be traded across that platform, then the answer would be probably yes. But look, as you know, when it comes to regulation, it'll be definitional in the end. So we'll see what the remit is.
And if the server maintaining that platform sits on a remote Pacific island and my customer is in his bedroom in Hong Kong online, it's going to be very difficult for you to regulate her, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, which is why the international standards aspect is so important.
Yeah,
because you're absolutely right. You know, that the you can do as much as you're able to in a jurisdiction, in an individual jurisdiction, but unless you have a global agreement, then, you know, then there's a problem. Then you get to the point where there may be one or two holdout jurisdictions, as it were, who want to indulge in regulatory arbitrage, but then you have to deal with that specifically.
Final question, because we're running to the end of our time. Where do you see all this heading? Where are we going to end up?
I think in the medium term, probably where we'll be is regulation of platforms. You know, from a regulation perspective, you know, I think there's no doubt that the same business, same risks, same rules approach will apply. I think the other area which we will be focusing on, which we are in Hong Kong, actually, I should have mentioned, is that what's the other sort of intersection point which regulators can focus on? Well, it's the degree to which traditional financial services, banks, asset managers, et cetera, are interacting with crypto and their clients.
So we have the on and off ramps between fiat and crypto.
Absolutely. And that actually is absolutely critical, that on off ramp piece, to get a greater understanding of what's happening in the crypto world and the attendant risks is super important. You know, so when it comes to conventional intermediaries, then, you know, again, it's an adaptation of concepts like suitability, you know, disclosure, valuation, risk management, conflicts of interest, etc. So, yeah, that's the thing where I think those two areas, platforms and the intersection between conventional financial services and crypto and their clients, that's where it's going to be headed. And then I think also the AML aspect is really quite important. You'd have seen that, you know, the travel rule under the FATF expectations, yeah, and all of that. Beyond that, that's medium term, I think. I don't really know, but I think because the industry develops the activity develops so quickly. But I think that ideas that this would operate autonomously or independently of conventional notions of regulation, I don't think that's going to happen.
I fully concur. That's and I think we're going to be looking at a new form of regulation and a new approach to regulation. And I look forward to us having that conversation in the future. So it's a standing open invitation to you to come back and talk to us about how that is all going. At this juncture, I'd like to thank you very much indeed. Ashley Alder, Chair of the Board of IOSCO, Chief Executive Officer of the Securities and Futures Commission in Hong Kong. You've been very generous with your time and with your thoughts. Fascinating conversation. Thank you very, very much for your contribution to the symposium. And we look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.